A few weeks ago, you might recall that the United Methodist Church held a denominational council to determine their official stance on same-sex marriage and the ordination of out LGBTQ or lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer pastors. A somewhat unexpected result came from that meeting, which was that they affirmed their traditional plan, which was a denominational opposition to full inclusion of LGBTQ people in the church. It was a really close vote, and some who watch religious matters closely say that we might see a split in the United Methodist Church in the coming months or years. I belonged to a United Methodist Church when I was in college. I was on my quest for a religious home, having just left the Southern Baptist Church. I was attending Southern Methodist University, so I tried out the Methodists. I loved their slogan, which was, and I believe still is, open hearts, open minds, open doors. But soon, at least in that congregation, which I was a member, I realized that that openness didn't go as far as I had hoped. It didn't fully, truly include my LGBTQ friends and family in the warm embrace of God's love. I was heartbroken to see that affirmed a few weeks ago in that denominational council. And so I left that congregation in college. I continued my quest, and a spam email and online quiz brought me to Unitarian Universalism. I fell in love with my UU church in Dallas, Texas, especially when I learned about the Welcoming Congregation program, which encourages not just tolerance, but full open-hearted embrace and celebration of LGBTQ folks in our congregations, in their fullness. Not asking them to hide or cut off a part of themselves, namely their sexuality and gender identity. I also loved the OWL curriculum, the Our Whole Lives curriculum. I had found a church that taught children and youth about healthy sexuality. Prior to my stint in United Methodism, I was an active Southern Baptist, and I had participated in abstinence education weekends. OWL's was a 180-degree turn from that, and I loved it. The first thing I ever did as a volunteer in a UU congregation was teach kindergarten through second grade OWL's. So how is it that we Unitarian Universalists came to such an open-hearted understanding of sex and sexuality? We were the first denomination to ordain openly gay ministers in the 1980s. You might recall what was happening in the 1980s. That might have made that particularly hard. We taught our youth about human sexuality, healthy human sexuality, as part of their religious education, their Sunday school, starting in the 1970s with the About Your Sexuality, or AYS, curriculum. That is now the Our Whole Lives, or OWL's, curriculum. OWL's was created by both the Unitarian Universalists and the United Church of Christ. It's a lifelong curriculum. It has multiple modules. The one we offer here is the most comprehensive one, the middle school, eighth grade curriculum. But there are OWL's modules starting as early as kindergarten through second grade. That's the one I taught as an early volunteer. A lot of head, shoulders, knees, and toes in that curriculum. Through elementary school, middle school, high school, young adulthood, adulthood, all the way to elderhood, there are curriculum modules for this program, because we realize, as people of faith, that sexuality is a healthy, normal part of the whole life in its richness and in its diversity, and that it's not confined to the ages between 20 and 50. It's the whole lifespan. So some of you know that I have a 3-year-old son, Nevin. You see him around here quite a bit. And he's 3, so potty training wasn't that long ago. And we had lots and lots of conversations about his penis. It's a normal part of potty training. He watched my husband and I go to the bathroom a lot. He was very curious about daddy's penis, his own. Where was mine? He's fluent in the language of his body. He's starting to understand that one of the reasons that he is a boy is that he has a penis, but that some boys' bodies don't have penises. He's recognizing at age 3 the flexibility of gender, that he isn't confined to this binary box that I inherited, that many of you inherited from our world. The other day in the car, where the most deep conversations happen, we were on our way to buy a present for my friend who just had a baby. He's sitting in the back seat in his car seat. He says, why does the baby live so far away? I said, because that's where the baby's moms live. He was quiet for a moment. The baby have 2 mommies? Yep, I said. Why the baby not have a daddy? I don't know. I guess the baby's moms met each other and they fell in love and they got married and they had a baby. He was quiet again for a moment. Oh, okay. That was it. I remember sighing in the front seat of the car. Oh man, I am just so glad that he is not going to have to unlearn the toxic messages of the world. That some faiths, that some cultures, some communities teach and instill about gender and sex and his body and sexuality. Of course, he's 3. There are going to be a lot more conversations and certainly a lot more messages that he will absorb from the world. But I feel so prepared as a UU parent, knowing that he's not only learning these messages of openness and inclusion at home, but here from you, from his RE program. Knowing that he will take OWLS, and hopefully we will be able to offer all the modules at some point, that he will have an open-hearted understanding of sex. My goal for my child, like most parents, I don't think I'm unique, is that he will grow up to be happy and healthy and well-adjusted. That's my high goal for my child. That I don't want him to have to fear that he's not loved because of his sexuality, or that something is wrong with him because he's having sexual feelings, or that he feels shame about his body and his natural functions. I want him to someday find love and connection with another human and for them to have a healthy, whole relationship. That's what I want for him. And as a UU, I feel confident that we are giving him the best head start we possibly can to a future without confining boxes or sexual shame. Which brings me now to money. Money. Like the word sex, money has that kind of squirmy feeling to it. Only because we don't talk about it much. We don't use that word much. We're not supposed to talk about it in polite company. Sure as heck not from the pulpit. Henry J.M. Nouwen, in the reading that Dave read for us earlier, said, "Money conversations are a greater taboo than conversations about sex or religion. Indeed, I have found this to be true, especially among liberals who pride ourselves on our openness about sex." Now, I can't remember where I saw this video. I searched high and low to locate it, but a few years ago I saw this video online where someone was interviewing strangers on the street. First, he would ask the person questions about their sex life, how active it was, their favorite positions. People were squeamish, but they mostly answered the questions on camera. And then the interviewer would ask them questions about money, about their bank balance, their credit card debt, their charitable giving habits, and people got mad. It wasn't just squeamishness at that point. People would clam up, they would refuse to answer, they would storm off. Now, when the author of that book from the reading says The reason for the taboo is that money has something to do with that intimate place in our hearts where we need security. Money is intimate. It has to do with security. Do we have enough? Enough to feel secure, enough to provide for ourselves and our families. That enoughness is something that our society, our capitalistic society, tries very hard to convince us that we do not have. Capitalism won't work as a system if we all think that we are enough and have enough. If we all felt fully secure, then the whole thing would fall apart. So our society has conflated money with worth. Sometimes this is a blatant message. Sometimes it is just really subconscious that we almost miss it. Lynn Twist discusses this idea in her book, The Soul of Money, that we heard the reading from earlier. She talks about the conflation of money and worth. She says, quote, "We measure our self-worth by our net worth. And only and always, more is better." But she suggests that there could be another way of thinking about money. Thinking about it as energy, as flow. Money as just yet another piece of the puzzle of our lives and our ability to connect with and impact the world. Just like we do with our time, our conversations, and our efforts. Money is one more of those things. If Marie asks you to sign up to help with something, to give your time, very few of us feel deeply offended by that. Usually we feel grateful for being asked, even if we don't have the time and we have to say no, right? Our money is like that. It is a normal, natural part of our lives. Sometimes we have enough to give, sometimes we don't. As Twist writes, grounded in sufficiency, enoughness. Money's movement in and out of our lives can feel natural. In sufficiency, we recognize and celebrate money's power for good. Our power to do good with it. Money is not good or bad in and of itself. It just is. But in preparing for this service, Steve and I were trying to find music that could be used for the special music part of this service, and we couldn't find anything. I challenge you to find one positive song about money. That's your homework. Go home and find one positive song about money. Really, if you find one, by all means, please tell me, because they are all about how money is evil or dirty or linked in some way to awful things. More money, more problems, right? This was not the message that we were trying to convey to you today. So we ended up with other music, generally about shame and relationships. Thank you, Steve. But no wonder we all have so many hang-ups about money. Our society is constantly telling us that it is a terrible thing. It's dirty. It's the root of all evil. And by the way, you should hoard it. Trying to unlearn these toxic messages about money is kind of like trying to unlearn the toxic messages that we get from the world about sex and sexuality, especially if we grew up in a socially conservative family or religion. Money is one of the primary reasons that people get divorced. Not because they don't have enough money, but because they have different opinions about how it should be managed or used, how much credit card debt is too much, or they're just feeling stressed about money in our society because we worry about it a lot. When I do premarital counseling with couples before they get married, I spend a big portion of our time on money, budgeting, opinions about debt, things like that. And it is often the first time that this couple has had that conversation after they've decided to get married. Money stress is also one of the leading factors in death by suicide. And why not? Because if we conflate our self-worth with our financial worth, And of course we do. The actual phrase in the financial world for your financial portfolio is your personal worth. If we conflate those two things, then fears about money can convey to a deep sense of unworthiness at your core. And as a minister, it's my life's calling to help people, to help us heal from the wounds of the world, to help people live into the fullness of life with wholeness and integrity. We Unitarian Universalists have been at the forefront for decades in helping people heal from the toxic messages of the world about sex and sexuality. We embrace people of every gender and sexual orientation. We decry any injustice facing anyone because of sexual or gender identity. We teach sex and relationship education as a normal part of the human experience in our religious education programs. These things can help people heal. I've seen it. To be fully whole human beings. Now, what if we could do the same for money? What if my son could learn, not just at home, but here at this fellowship, that money isn't dirty, that it isn't shameful, that it isn't terrible to have a lot of money, that it isn't terrible to have very little? What if he could learn that the stewardship season was a time of celebration? An offering of our gifts, and not that, oh man, here we go again, time. What if my son could learn that asking for money from the ministerial discretionary fund was something that anyone could do when they needed it without shame? Because I see this. People generously give to that fund, to our ministerial discretionary fund, in small amounts or large amounts, and they do it willingly of their own volition. Joyfully. But when someone needs to ask for money from that fund, there's always a level of shame. And there doesn't need to be. It's a beautiful, powerful thing that we offer. And we're so glad that we have the means to be able to offer it. What if my son could learn that when he's old enough to have an allowance, that he is expected, not encouraged, expected to share those financial gifts with others by supporting the fellowship and supporting the community? Oh, I desperately want for my son, for all children, for all of us, to have a healthy relationship with money. One that doesn't send these conflicting messages. One that doesn't tell us that our bank balance is a reflection of our personal worth. One that doesn't encourage us to hoard money as a sense of anxiety or fear or not enoughness. I want us to be the religion that helps people heal from money shame, that helps people talk out loud about how much money they have and how much money they give. I want to be able to say, I give this much to the fellowship because I believe it's an important part of my life, because I have the means to do that, because I want people to receive the benefits of this UU fellowship just like I have. And I also want people to be able to say, if I lose my job or I have some financial crisis, I feel confident that I can change the amount of money that I give to the fellowship easily and that I can ask for financial help if I need it. And since I want this for you, for all of us, I'm going to be brave, and I'm going to model what I want us to be able to do. So here goes. My husband, Brian, and I feel incredibly lucky. We're lucky that for now, we are solidly middle class, whatever that means. We are not rich. But we're grateful that we both have jobs. We know that that is not true for many families. We have health insurance. We can pay our bills on time. We both have student debt, quite a bit of it. I have a lot of medical expenses all the time. We adopted our first child, and we're in the process of adopting a second child, and adoption is not cheap. But it's how that we are making our family. We pay the same amount as our mortgage to cover our daycare costs. We don't have a ton of savings because of all of those things, except what our jobs have set aside in our 401k, and for that we're very grateful. But hopefully someday we will be able to have more savings. Daycare will come to an end, I'm told. We typically can go on one vacation a year. It's usually to see our family, nothing extravagant. But one of our core values that me and my husband hold is that we support the institutions that we utilize and that give back to our community. We pledge to NPR. We give to some charities, including Every Town for Gun Sense. But our biggest pledge, by far, is to this place, to this fellowship. Now, that could feel weird because you pay my salary. But we still think it's important to give. This is our faith community, too. And so we pledge. We promise each year at this time that we're going to pay over the coming year. And last year, we pledged and paid $3,600 for the year. That's $300 a month. That was our pledge. And this year, our pledge campaign is asking for a 10% increase. Overall, we recognize that won't be possible for every family, but overall, we need about a 10% increase to reach our goal. And so my family decided that we could do that. So we are increasing our pledge by 10% to $330 per month. We hope after our son is out of daycare, it does end, right? And that our next kid is adopted, that we will be able to afford more. We love this place. We love our faith community. We want people to be able to come here and find hope and depth and challenge and love. We want people, regardless of sexuality or gender identity or income, to be welcomed here with open arms. Now, some people in this room can pledge a lot more than my family can and do. Some can't pledge nearly that amount. We all have very different means, different incomes, different situations in our lives, and that is perfectly fine. There's no shame in that, none at all. But we need everyone to give with intention and attention so that this community will be able to continue to provide the services, the resources, the opportunities that we do. It's not evil. It's just reality. It's just energy. We need money, just like we need time, to keep things going. And so I ask you to contemplate truly your relationship with money. What did you learn as a child from your family? What messages did you receive or not receive? What emotions come up when you start thinking about money? Do you have enough? And if not, what does enough look like? Because without that idea of what enough might look like, we will never have enough. Are the toxic messages from the world impacting your choices about money? Or are you just sitting in your chair right now feeling completely unsure because you never think about it and no one ever talks about it? That's also fine. This is why we have to heal our relationship with money. So that when you hear someone say, this is how much I have or give, it doesn't trigger in you guilt or shame. That it just triggers, oh, that's an interesting piece of information that I learned. I wonder about myself. We have to heal our relationship with money so that we can use it wisely, with intention. And I believe Unitarian Universalists have a huge role to play here. We could take the lead in helping people heal from money shame, from fear, from squeamishness. We have proven our ability to do so with sex. We have a track record on that front. We have helped people feel welcome and included and loved just as they are. We can do the same for money. We can overcome our own anxieties, our own early childhood learning. We can ground ourselves in a sense of sufficiency, in a sense of enoughness. That's our first principle, that you have inherent worth. Regardless of your bank account, you have worth. And that you can use that worthiness to align your time, your talent, and your money in a way that serves your values. That we can give generously, whatever that means. That might be a very small number on your pledge card. It might be a huge number. But that can be very generous for you. That we can give and we can also ask when we are in need without shame. We can do all of these things. And we can and we must. Amen. May it be so.